war will not start. That will be the win. We should not collapse or bring some countries to collapse as they did with the Soviet Union. On the political map of Europe, each and every country today presents a guarantee that something bad will not happen, that the military conflict will not break out. You see what happened in Ukraine. That's because of lack of confidence and lack of security granted for all countries. You cannot be secure if you bring insecurity to your neighbors. So the neighborhood, we consider the neighborhood is the main asset that we have to share and we have to preserve with all our neighbors. And I mentioned that numerously on the OSCE premises. We don't want to see the NATO at our borders. We want to see Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Ukraine and Russia. As in the sense of neighborhood, it's vital for us.
At the same time, you mentioned avoiding a war. The world is moving into a new direction towards a multipolar world. The North American domination is clearly coming to an end, but particularly the European Union is unwilling to accept it. We recently see the introduction of the Rearm Europe program, conscription in France, in Germany, building massive armies. They even talk about we need to go to war against Russia. How can a war actually be avoided?
Well, the war can be avoided with the perception that it will bring no victory to some separate countries. This will bring blood, victims, destructed infrastructure. Unfortunately, those who rearm their armies and enhance the level of militarization, they have forgotten about the pain and tragedy that war has brought to their countries. And I think that I do believe that we don't need a new war to understand that, because war is very expensive, very unpredictable, and it will economically it's not efficient means of solving the problems. The only efficient way, maybe longer than the military conflict, but very stable and will bring more profit when we sit and again discuss things instead of militarize, pump money into the military budgets and enhance the military industry and enhance the army, because it's not economically necessary, and it will bring the traditional spheres of the economy to a collapse.
But at the same time, we see increasingly a move of some states to work outside the international law framework. United States, Israel, with their attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, breaking international law, and these attacks had no consequences for these countries, no consequences at the UN Security Council. How can international rule-based order re-established?
You know, the architecture, international architecture, and the rule of law has been not destroyed, but in a bad shape at the moment. I agree with you. How could we restore that? By restoring confidence, by restoring trust, by showing each other that we respect international law, which has been created by many generations before us. And we should create new mechanisms that will help to build, rebuild it, that and restore that trust and confidence. I do agree with you that the secretariats of international organizations, often monopolized by certain countries' representatives, that don't want to talk about any appeasement, any peaceful solution on different matters. And what the Security Council, as I mentioned, reflects the current state of the intergovernmental relations. So sooner or later, I believe in the force of diplomacy, we will sit and decide that, because many countries already that are trying to support military operation in Ukraine. They realize that their communities are lacking something very substantial: social standards, the energy tariffs, the cost of living is not as it used to be even 5 or 10 years ago. So I think that the policymakers should realize that they are specifically designed and brought to their positions not to start the wars, but to finish and end up the conflicts and to settle problems and make their best to enhance the standard of living for their population, for their communities. People are against the war, that's evident, but on the West, they are frightened, they are scared by everyday's reports, information reports, saying that one country is an aggressor, somebody there is their supporters, and so on. But, you know, this is today's everyday's routine, unfortunately. But I do believe that the glass is more than half full than empty. So we are doing, you know, with our colleagues, a lot of job at the moment to find right formats and right solutions in the sphere of international relations and in our region. And the topic number one on my desk every day is the security issues, situation on the border, and relations with the neighbors.
And final question, coming back to the third Eurasian Security Conference in Minsk. Really high profile conference if you look at the participants, contrary to the OSCE meeting in Vienna at the moment. We saw personal participation of the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We saw high profile representation from many other countries like China, Hungary, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran. But I'm wondering how this conference and the debate and discussions at this conference can be turned into practice to strengthen Eurasian security.
It's already been transferred into a practice, because as a follow-up, we see the numerous consultations between the ministries, we see the interaction of analytical community, we continue the meetings in a smaller formats of representatives that were part of our conference. We see the articles and we see the effects in, you know, more predictable and friendly relations between countries participating on that conference. We see new perspectives for the trade turnover and economic relations. I think that the money spent to organize that conference, we've saved a lot of resources due to that event. More and more people do believe what they saw with their own eyes and do not believe in what they read or hear every day from TV or from internet. They see how country looks like, they see how people are living, and that even enhances the diplomatic efforts that we maintain every day.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deputy Foreign Minister Igor Segretta. That's all we have time for now. Thank you for joining us from the UN headquarters, the Vienna International Center, here on Face to Face, and goodbye for now.
ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, we have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature for quite a while now, and we'd like to continue along the same line. Let me ask you this question, Sheikh. What are the general Islamic laws or Sharia laws regarding a kind of mixing or gash? This is what the terminology in fact holds in the transactions and trade, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, of course.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is no doubt that cheating and deception or using any tactics to deceive the customer is forbidden.
Yes.
Actually, to play a trick on someone and to sell goods which are defective,
right,
is not permissible. And in the event that the buyer comes to know that the property or the good or the item he has purchased,
yes,
is defective, he has the option and the right to cancel the transaction,
mm-hmm,
and return the good and get his money back.
Right. Well, these are the general laws, right?
No, yeah,
regarding
of course. Any dishonest practices are forbidden in Islam.
Mm.
It's not permissible to conduct any such practices, whether the customer is Muslim or non-Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it is necessary for every vendor or any seller to be honest and to show to be trustworthy and to tell if there is any defect in the item or in the good or utensil or whatever he sells. If there is any defect, he should frankly tell the other person,
right,
that this is the defect, and if you want to purchase it, you should purchase with previous knowledge and understanding of the defect.
How about dishonest, in fact, people or individuals who are involved in a kind of transaction? Like, for example, you're going to buy something from someone and they don't inform you of the technical defects, as you mentioned.
Right.
So can you, give them, for example, something of a lesser, let's say, value, like shortchange the person or something like that by being dishonest as a kind of reaction to the dishonest or unscrupulous, for example, transaction that they held for you?
You're right. The person who sells, he is not entitled to the money he receives, because the person who buys, he buys it as something which is flawless, which is completely perfect,
mm-hmm,
and it is sound and there's no defect in it.
Right.
So he buys it with that intention. While the seller knows that there is such a defect. It's if for example, he sells a cow,
right,
and the cow suffers from an illness,
right,
or suffers from some kind of problem,
mm-hmm,
and he does not reveal the
right
truth to the, mm-hmm, to the buyer. So the buyer has two options here. One is the khiyar al haywan, then the option for returning the animal,
yes,
and getting his money back. And the other is, of course, the khiyar, or the option for for the defect.
Mm.
Okay, khiyar al-aib is the option for the defect.
What can he do?
When he should, he has the right to either get the adjust the amount,
right?
Take the money, some of portion of the money,
right,
back, and go ahead and use the product or the animal, or else he can return the product or whatever he is
has
defective.
Purchased.
Yes, he has purchased to the seller.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javid, what is the rule regarding forgetting, for example, the content or the text that we are required to read, for example, during qunut in a prayer?
Well, qunut is not obligatory per se.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person forgets any zikr of the qunut, he can change the zikr and recite another zikr,
right.
Another zikr, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Any dua that you recite, whether it is in Farsi or in Arabic, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
The religious authorities have allowed to recite,
right.
Have allowed to recite any zikr. So
right.
Qunut in itself is not wajib, let alone the zikr or the askar which we might want to recite in it.
Mm, I see. Well, how about, in fact, mispronunciation in the prayer? Does it matter whether, for example, this pronunciation takes place in or during recommended prayer or obligatory ones?
Okay. Mispronunciation, you know, it's a defect, it's a problem. And the duty-bound, the mukallaf, is supposed to work on improving his pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to make every effort to pronounce as correctly as possible. And at the same time, he must make sure that he improves his pronunciation. Okay. Wrong pronunciation gives a wrong meaning, gives the wrong sense. Yes. And it denotes something else. So if a person knows that his pronunciation is wrong, he must improve it. And if a person knows that, for example, a certain prayer leader does not pronounce the letters and words of the prayer correctly, he cannot stand behind him and offer his prayers with jama'ah.
Right.
He must offer his prayers individually in that case. So the thing is that if a person is in a position and able to improve his pronunciation, he must do so.
I see.
And he must do his best to pronounce the letters as correctly as possible. Of course, he has to consult people who know how to pronounce.
Yes. Sheikh Javid, you know, we are not talking about the Middle Easterns or Middle Easterners or Muslims or Arabs who would know, like by default, for example, the correct pronunciation of the Arabic terms or terminologies when it comes especially to obligatory rituals,
right,
such as the prayers. We are talking about, for example, people coming back actually from different walks of life, different backgrounds, and different linguistic backgrounds, actually.
Right.
All right? For example, it's pretty hard. Let me give you a very clear case.
Right.
It's pretty hard for English-speaking people to pronounce kh sound, for example.
Right.
Right? Which is prevalent in Arabic.
Yes.
A lot. So, or the differences between, for example, fa and sa and the and the, sad, zad, you know, all of these sounds in Arabic are even somehow difficult, I guess, for the Arabs to pronounce, not to mention, or let alone, for example, people with different other languages, basically. So it's pretty hard, basically, for them to pronounce the correct requirement when it comes to pronunciation of those words, right?
Yes. So the thing is that one should do as far as it lies within him to improve his pronunciation. And God does not obligate a person beyond his capacity.
Right.
Okay, you are honest in your pronunciation and you are trying your best. God knows the truth. And if possible, even for a new, let's say converted, or convert, he is supposed to improve his pronunciation. I know his pronunciation is going to be, it is in the very beginning. It is not
perfect.
Perfect, yes. Okay, he might not be able to pronounce K, H as K,
right,
while he pronounces it as K. Okay,
yes.
God knows the truth.
I see.
And he knows how sincere you are.
Mm-hmm.
But you are also trying and trying to, but doesn't, but that doesn't mean that you should keep praying because you are not able to pronounce prayers. Okay, you should at the same time. Even people who are deaf and dumb, you know, people who cannot speak, they are supposed to pray. They cannot even pronounce any words.
Okay.
They cannot speak any words. The dumb, especially, okay, they are supposed to use gestures instead of making words.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are talking about the or some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Tawheed, do people have to, in fact, make a ghusl or ablution after miscarriage?
Of course they should. It is wajib for ladies who experience miscarriage to do ghusl. There are two ghusl that becomes obligatory on a lady who experiences miscarriage. One is the ghusl for touching a dead body because the fetus comes into contact with her body.
Yes.
The child is born dead and that is ghusl for touching a dead body. And the second ghusl is ghusl for the postnatal bleeding, the bleeding that occurs, okay? This is called ghusl nifas, okay? So she should do two major ablutions. One is ghusl mas for a dead body, and then one is ghusl nifas. And of course, if she performs one ghusl with the intention of both of them, it would be sufficient. She is not supposed to repeat the ghusl and do it again twice.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. I think that is the case, or that rule applies to every kind of ghusl, right?
Yes,
imagine that you can just have one, you know, ghusl with lots of niyyah, right?
Yeah, of
intentions.
Course. Right.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to delve into some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو
about you. IRIB English Radio.
Professor Mearsheimer, welcome here, my dear friend. Before we talk about can Europe save Ukraine, I just finished reading a great piece that you wrote. It may have been derived from a speech that you gave on the bleak future that Europe has. But before we get there, our dear friend and colleague Alistair Crook is reporting that Israeli press is reporting that Prime Minister Netanyahu is threatening Israeli President Herzog over the issue of the pardon, and contrary to Israeli law, is unwilling to admit guilt and unwilling to leave public office. I'm going to guess that you're not surprised by any of this.
Hardly at all. I mean, Netanyahu is someone who is deeply committed to remaining in office for as long as he possibly can. As we've talked about on the show, he's done a brilliant job at prolonging his tenure as prime minister, given the fact that he was the prime minister on October 7th when Israel was caught by surprise and suffered that devastating defeat that day. And furthermore, given that he has been under indictment and has been in court well over a year now, the fact that he survived is quite remarkable. He has no intention of leaving office. So he'll cut a deal, but it's only if it's a deal that leaves him in office and basically leaves him unscathed.
I'm going to guess that this doesn't surprise you either. The Financial Times is reporting that Arab leaders have told President Trump that they will not accept Tony Blair on the so-called Trump Peace Board. They absolutely reject him. I'm trying to say this with a straight face as the governor general. I can't imagine that he's going to live in Gaza anyway. They're going to reject him as the governor general of Gaza.
No, it's very interesting. Is Haaretz has a big piece today that says in the headline that Tony Blair has been visiting Netanyahu since October 7th on a frequent basis.
I saw that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy is in bed with the Israelis. The idea that he's going to be the one who administers Gaza. I mean, when you think about what's going on with regard to Gaza, it's really quite amazing. The two principal negotiators for the United States are Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who are dyed-in-the-wool Zionists. They should not be negotiating for the United States with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then you throw in Tony Blair, who's not much different than Kushner, and Witkoff. This looks like a colonial enterprise, what Trump is trying to do in Gaza. There's no self-determination whatsoever for the Palestinians in this deal that he's concocted for Gaza. There's no political horizon. There's no self-determination. Basically, he's going to have a bunch of Europeans running it, and he's going to be nominally in charge, he meaning Trump. And then they're going to bring in some Arab and Islamic countries to police the place. This is the idea. This is a non-starter. It's just not going to work. By the way, just to take this a step further, a number of countries, Pakistan, Indonesia, for example, who have been mentioned as possible countries that would put peacekeeping forces in Gaza have said they will not go into Gaza until Hamas is disarmed. And Hamas, of course, is not going to disarm. They'd be crazy to disarm because there is no hope of a political endgame for the Palestinians. There's no self-determination here. If Hamas disarmed, they'd leave themselves wide open to the IDF.
Can Netanyahu claim with a straight face, suppose we could stop right there and I just fill in the blank. Anybody could fill in the blank. Can he claim with a straight face that his government is abiding by the Witkoff-Kushner-Trump so-called ceasefire?
Not with a straight face. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Lebanon, if you look at what's happening in Gaza, there's abundant evidence, a superabundant of evidence that the Israelis are not abiding by the ceasefire. They violated on a consistent basis in Lebanon, and they violated on a consistent basis in Gaza. And what does the United States do in these cases? It stands idly by and allows the Israelis to do whatever they want. We continue to fund them, and we continue to give them equipment and support them diplomatically if they ever get into any trouble.
Just like the Congress of the United States sits idly by and lets the president do whatever he wants, even when he's murdering people on the high seas in the Caribbean Ocean, 1,500 miles from the United States.
That's true. But at least the Congress is beginning to get cold feet. They're beginning to get nervous.
Right.
You don't see any of that in terms of how Trump deals with the Israelis or how Congress deals with the Israelis. And that's basically because, as I've said on numerous occasions, the lobby owns Trump and the lobby owns Congress.
Right, right. I mean, is there any feasible way to stop these killings, these criminal acts on the Caribbean, other than perhaps scaring Congress into thinking its members will not be reelected once the public sees the murders on film?
That's possible. I'd say the likelihood of that happening is in the range of 5 to 10%. I mean, the truth is, if Congress decided to take the bull by the horns and get tough with Trump, I think he'd just ignore them.
Here's Senator Rand Paul. Actually, earlier today on this, Chris, cut number 10.
We've been doing this for 30 years. When the Coast Guard picks up boats off of Venezuela, which we have done historically, about 1 in 4 of the boats, maybe 1 in 5, don't have drugs. So we make mistakes. Are we willing to execute people with a 20% error rate? This is an insane policy. It's inconsistent. It's not war, and it's not the way we've ever done this. Think about it. If we can blow up a boat in the ocean that is at war with us because of the drugs, what about when they get to Miami and they put it in a truck, and the truck's going from Miami to Orlando? Can you shoot a grenade launcher at the truck? No, we arrest people because sometimes we're wrong. You know, the make and the model of the truck is this, and oh, we made a mistake. That was somebody on vacation. We don't blow up people without first arresting them. And this is the way it's been done on the high seas for 100 years or more. And what we're doing now is just plain wrong.
It's a classic, constitutionally faithful clarion cry for something as simple and basic as due process.
I agree. It's hard to disagree with anything that Senator Paul said. I would also note that I think that it's very important that people pay attention to the rule of law, both domestically and internationally. I mean, we have laws for good reason. And I understand that sometimes countries have to violate the law because it's in their security, it's in their national interest. It makes sense from a security point of view. But you want to minimize the number of times you do that and otherwise follow the law as much as possible. And the same thing is true at the domestic level. And in this country, with regard to our leadership, and I think it was true with the Biden administration as well, paying attention to the law was just not that important. We thought we could do pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And the only difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration at the international level is that the Biden administration trumpeted the virtues of the international legal system, the rule of law internationally, while in practice they were stomping all over it. The Trump administration, at least, is consistent. They're constantly railing against the rules-based order or international law, while at the same time traipsing all over it.
Well, see if you can figure out what the president meant here, because first he says we will release the second tape, the tape showing the survivors clinging onto chunks of wood for 45 minutes before they were murdered. And then he said, I never said I'd release the tape. And then he said he wasn't sure what he said. Let's see if you can figure it out what he means. Number 11.
Mr. President, you released video of that first boat strike on September 2nd, but not the second video. Will you release video of that strike so that the American people can see for themselves what
happened? I don't know what they have, but whatever they have, we'd certainly release. No problem.
Mr. President.
President, you said you would have no problem with releasing the full video of that strike on September 2nd off the coast of Venezuela.
Secretary Hegseth now says...
You said that. I didn't say that. This is ABC fake news.
You said that you would have no problem releasing the full bit. Okay, well, Secretary Hegseth...
Whatever Hegseth wants to do is okay with
me. He now says it's under review. Are you ordering the secretary to release that full video?
Well, whatever he decides is okay with me.
Are you committed to releasing the full video?
Didn't I just tell you that?
You said that it was
You're
up to Secretary Hegseth.
You're the most obnoxious reporter in the whole place. Let me just tell you, you are an obnoxious, a terrible reporter.
Well, this is really ridiculous coming from the President of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say at this point?
All right, let's transition. When the Kremlin agreed to disband the Warsaw Pact, why did the United States stay in NATO?
We stayed in NATO because we understood that we served as a pacifier in Europe. At least in the western half of Europe. As long as NATO was intact, that meant the United States was there and it had its security umbrella over the West Europeans. Now, it's very important to understand that when the Soviets disbanded the Warsaw Pact, they were nevertheless content to leave NATO intact. They were content to allow the United States to remain in Europe, because the Soviets understood that we did act as a pacifier. And this is especially relevant with regard to West Germany, which was in the process of becoming Germany. Because you remember at the end of the Cold War, Germany was reunified. So the German reunification caused worries all across Europe. And people thought that the best way to deal with that potential problem was to keep NATO intact, which meant keep the Americans in Europe. We bought that argument, the Europeans bought that argument, and the Soviets and later the Russians bought that argument. So there's no problem there. Where does the problem come? It comes with NATO expansion.
Right.
You well know, Judge, we told the Soviets that we would not expand NATO, that it would not be expanded eastward. And then the Clinton administration came along and they decided in 1994 that NATO would be expanded. And that is the principal source of the problem today. Had we not expanded NATO, and certainly if we had not expanded NATO or tried to expand NATO into Ukraine, Europe, I believe, would be peaceful today.
Instead, you have argued, this is a great piece, it's at the American Conservative, it probably appears elsewhere. Did you give it as a speech or did you write it as as an editorial?
No, I gave it as a speech before the European Parliament.
Okay, because I could hear your voice and enjoy, actually rejoice in some of your favorite figures of speech. And you argued so powerfully that Europe's future is bleak. Why do you say that?
It's very bleak for two reasons. One is there's not going to be a happy ending to the Ukraine war. The Russians are going to win an ugly victory. Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And very importantly, relations between Russia on one side and Ukraine and Europe on the other side are going to be poisonous. And they're going to be dangerous because there's always a possibility, given all the flashpoints that exist in Eastern Europe, that a war will break out again. So once the war ends, once the shooting stops and you get some sort of armistice or frozen conflict, the potential for conflict, armed conflict, is still going to be there. And you want to remember you're operating in an environment where there are poisonous relations. The other point, and this is of great importance, is that the United States is pivoting to Asia in a major way. You see this in the new national security strategy that the Trump administration has just put out. We view China as our principal concern. And there's a great deal of emphasis in the administration, and especially with Trump himself, in focusing on East Asia and leaving the Europeans to defend for themselves. So what I'm saying here, Judge, is that if we pivot to East Asia, which I think is likely, the end result is that NATO will definitely collapse, or it certainly will be a shell of its former self. And the end result is that the Europeans will be on their own to provide for their own security. And the Europeans live in fear of that possibility. So I think when you put all these things together, it's a very bleak future for Europe.
So the Sun of London, which is a tabloid, reports just a few minutes ago that a British soldier was killed in Ukraine. Now, Colonel McGregor informs that many British special forces and MI6 have been killed, but none of it's been revealed. This time they revealed it because it happened out of a training accident and the press was there, and the guy was in uniform. Is this going to affect the Kremlin thinking at all, that a British soldier in uniform was killed in Ukraine?
No, I don't think they're going to care at all, for two reasons. One, I'm sure they already know that there are British soldiers in Ukraine. Not many of them, but some of them. The fact is, the Russians are principally concerned with waging the war on the battlefield, and whether there are 10 British soldiers, 100 British soldiers, or even 1,000 British soldiers just doesn't matter very much. And more importantly, the British are not going to put in 1,000 soldiers. They're not going to directly engage in the fight in any meaningful way. So this just doesn't matter very much.
If you had been a fly on the wall at 10 Downing Street yesterday when Volodymyr Zelensky showed up and was greeted by Sir Keir Starmer, President Emmanuel Macron, and Chancellor Merz, what do you think you would have heard? What could they possibly say to him? They can't raise taxes. They can't borrow money. Belgium won't let them steal the money from the Belgian banks. What can they do for him?
Well, unless they can steal that money, those frozen Russian assets from Euroclear, there's hardly anything they can do. Ukraine is certainly doomed if that proves to be the case. So I think what they probably told Zelensky at this point in time is to hold the line, and they would do everything they can to steal that money and make sure that Ukraine gets the $100+ billion that it desperately needs so they can continue the war. I mean, there's no question that the Europeans, much like the Ukrainians, are profoundly committed to keeping this war going. They obviously think that there's some chance that the Russians will collapse before Ukraine collapses, and that we will emerge, we meaning the West, and the Ukrainians will emerge victorious. I think this is tilting at windmills, but it's quite clear that the Europeans seem to believe that.
President Trump, in another one of his rants, we don't have it on tape, apparently said he doesn't like the Europeans, he doesn't trust them, and he's thinking of walking away from Ukraine. Now, he said that before, so I don't know that we can put much credence in it. And we just watched that clip where he said, yeah, release the tape, and 5 hours later denied that he had said it. So these sort of wild, almost ridiculous, at times hilarious interactions with the press in the Oval Office, I don't think they can really be fairly used as a window into his thinking.
Well, one way of thinking about what's going on, which ties this discussion of Trump to the previous question about the three European leaders and Zelensky, is that everybody now understands that Ukraine is going to lose. And the question is, who's going to get the blame? Who's going to bear the responsibility for the loss? And one could argue that Trump will not simply walk away from Ukraine, because that will then allow the Ukrainians, and especially the Europeans, to blame him for the collapse of Ukraine. So the smart thing for Trump to do in this story is to say, this is a European responsibility, and I will do everything I can to help the Europeans keep the Ukrainians afloat. So that's the Trump perspective. From the European side of the equation, there, I think, they want to fight and fight and fight, fight to the last Ukrainian, so they cannot be accused of having bailed out on Ukraine, and can actually make the argument that it's Trump who's responsible for Ukraine's collapse. So what I'm saying to you here is I have to believe, given what's happening on the battlefield, that the Europeans, certainly Donald Trump, understand that Ukraine is doomed, that they're going to lose this war, and there's no way of turning the tide. And therefore, the question is a blame game, or the question is who gets the blame? You're involved.
Right. And Trump is a master at deflecting blame.
Oh, he's brilliant at that. And the Europeans are very good at that as well.
Mm.
Because you want to understand that this is going to be a catastrophic defeat. This is not a minor defeat. This is not like losing in Afghanistan. This is a major war where Europe and the United States, or NATO more generally, was on one side, and the Russians were on the other.
You know who he'll blame it on. He'll blame it on Biden, and Biden does bear a lot of blame, but he does, Trump as well, for arming the Ukrainians before Biden was in office and for continuing to arm them after he came to office the second time. Here is this statement, a bizarre statement he made, as if that's news, claiming that President Zelensky hasn't even, I don't know how he could know this, hasn't even read the so-called 28-point proposal. There's a little bit more in there. We'll let you see it and hear it now. Chris, number six.
What's your next step in Russia-Ukraine talks after last week's negotiations?
So we've been speaking to President Putin, and we've been speaking to Ukrainian leaders, including Zelensky, President Zelensky. And I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people love it, but he hasn't. Russia's fine with it. Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country when you think of it. But Russia is, I believe, fine with it. But I'm not sure that Zelensky's fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
It's really crazy. His people don't love it. Russia's not fine with it. How could he know whether or not it's been read? That was, by the way, Sunday evening. I misspoke when I said Saturday.
The Russians don't accept this 28-point plan. The Ukrainian people, and I assume by that he means all of Zelensky's advisors, all the key national security establishment figures in Ukraine, they don't accept this plan for one second.
Right.
Zelensky himself, I can't believe he hasn't read it. I'm sure he has, but he surely knows what's in it if he hasn't read it, and he completely rejects it. This is what he said yesterday when he talked to the press after meeting with the three European leaders. He doesn't accept the deal. Nobody accepts the deal. That's the problem. There's no deal to be had here.
This is the love has dyed me in blood. Lord, I'm wise, neither minute. Your love caused me all the joy, took my heart and made fond of it. Desired to kill. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Me deeply involved in this. like the roadside now and then, like the floods I flow. I'm Yunus, mystic of sorrow, suffering wounds from top to toe. In the hands of beloved, I write in woe. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. During the Middle Ages, the Muslim world had two numerous business advantages. They had a huge range of contacts, so they could trade everything from African gold to Chinese porcelain to European amber and furs. And Muslim craft workers were highly skilled, which meant their goods always found a really market. Without Muslim merchants, Europeans would have had no rice, sugar, or coffee. Approximately 5 to 8 million Muslims lived in the United States, and there are over 1,200 mosques. Muslims have been a part of the cultural landscape in America for the past 200 years. The Islamic Empire once stretched into modern-day Europe, particularly in Spain and the Balkans. Today, there are tens of millions of Muslims living in Europe. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We'll start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have Let's Recite the Quran. The program teaches eloquent recitation of the Holy Quran at level 2. A to Z of Life will be our final program this hour. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Stay with us.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome. As Benjamin Netanyahu's war on Gaza continues under open and unconditional U.S. political and military protection, its consequences are no longer confined to occupied Palestine. The policies of mass killing and collective punishment are now producing global repercussions, fueling anger, polarization, and insecurity far beyond the region. At the center of these repercussions, Jewish communities around the world are increasingly paying the price for policies that do not represent them. As a dangerous conflagration takes hold between the crimes of Israel's government and Jewish identity itself, much like Muslims were collectively blamed worldwide after the crimes of groups such as ISIS, the recent terrorist attack in Sydney, along with similar incidents elsewhere, raise urgent questions about how Netanyahu's wars have become a catalyst for global violence and about the future or failure of the international community to stop a conflict that's threatening global peace and security. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Zakaria Zainab. First of all, let's introduce the guest. Daniel Jessic is author and researcher who joins us from Barcelona. And we also have William Leon, who is political analyst, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Let me start with Daniel in Barcelona. I mean, the war in Gaza, can we still classify it as localized? Is it still a localized conflict, or as Netanyahu turn it into a source of global insecurity?
I think the consequences of the genocide that is being committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, in Palestine, have been felt around the world. Of course, the Israeli regime as such has always necessitated foreign support in terms of weapons, economic and political infrastructure. So the genocide itself would not have been possible without the staunch support of the United States in particular, and of course NATO, European Union, and other major allies of the Israeli regime. So the oppression of Palestinians has, throughout history, been a very transnational one. If the United States withdrew its weapons support to the Israeli regime today, the apartheid regime would not be able to sustain itself for long. So there has always been a very international investment into the settler colonial advance. At the same time, what we've seen in the last, in particular, 2 years,